It's really fun today to be here with Corey David Barker, who contacted me about a book that he has written. He's the lead author on a book with a number of other co-authors. The book is called Foundations of Archdisciplinarity, which is kind of a big word, but Corey's going to break that down for us. Interestingly, one of his co-authors is Brendan Graham Dempsey, whose name has popped up in the corner quite a lot recently. And just yesterday, I was having a conversation with Rafe Kelly, and Rafe mentioned that he'd been talking quite a bit with Brendan. So it'll be interesting to see how that all fits together. And before we get started with looking into the book, Corey, maybe you could tell me what it was that led you to write this book and what was on your heart and what you think it might accomplish.
I don't know. It's sort of like asking that question and then giving an answer is looking at like the whole trajectory of the development of me as a person. And
Yes, exactly. That's what we want to hear.
there's like the long-winded version, but I could probably try and give like a nutshell version, which is that when I was a teenager, I got really interested in comparative religion. And then that led me to Carl Jung and the work that he did. And so by the time I was in my early 20s, I had read basically everything he wrote. And I don't consider myself a Jungian per se. I mean, one of the things that Jung said was that each person needs to individuate themselves and find their own truth. And then, like if you find other people who are coming to similar conclusions, then you can come together. And but from reading Jung, I got interested in comparative psychology. And also he did a lot of like bringing in the humanities in terms of like comparative philosophy, comparative religion in terms of like the entry point that I found him. And so yeah, then it was comparative philosophy, and then it arrived at comparison of sciences, and then it was, how can I fit together everything everyone knows about everything? Jung had this sort of notion of archetypes in people. And so I wondered if there were archetypes in nature. And so, yeah, I just ended up doing this long autodidactic inquiry, spending all day at the library for like a year and a half, reading encyclopedias and ordering books and seeing if I could find universal patterns in nature. And I did. And I created a framework out of it. But I also noticed that like other people had their own sort of frameworks, these sort of like big picture frameworks that try and find unity across all of human knowledge. So yeah, like over time, eventually I ended up doing a master's and did inquiry into social science and discovered developmental psychology and yeah, I mean that's sort of like the nutshell of kind of how I got there. There's the sort of like recognizing disciplines, looking at the interdisciplinary relationships that exist between them, and then eventually broadening out to the point where all disciplines are brought in, and then looking at different ways that people try and fit everything together. And then that's how I and others who are part of ARC, the Archdisciplinary Research Center, that's how we sort of like found each other and formed the organization. And so this book, Foundations of Archdisciplinarity, is basically, like the state of the art of where we're at in terms of advancing human understanding in this way.
So, does that differ from consilience?
Well, I mean, in what context are you talking about, like E.O. Wilson's Consilience?
I mean, I read part of that book. I got discouraged with it because the reason I bought the book was that I started thinking that my way of thinking was a kind of consilience, but the way that I think about all these different disciplines is more like they are kind of all one thing, in the same way that you could have, there's some physics term I can't remember, some paradox, Tarski, some there's something Tarski paradox where you can
Alfred
have
Tarski.
many,
Alfred Tarski.
well, Banach-Tarski paradox, where you have a sphere, but the sphere is actually made up of many spheres, each of which is unique to itself, but somehow they're all interconnected. That's more the way I think of all the disciplines, but the way E.O. Wilson wrote that book, Consilience, is more that they all stack up on top of each other, one learning from the one below, so that they're not equal in a sense, but some are foundational and then some build from there. I think that's right.
Yeah, okay. So there's different languages that people use to describe the evolution of human advancement. And one of those lineages is in terms of scopes of inquiry. So there's disciplinarity, interdisciplinarity, transdisciplinarity, and now we're introducing archdisciplinarity. So the notion of consilience actually can carry all the way through. So like if you're working just in one discipline, in one domain, you want to integrate everything you understand that belongs to that domain, understand the total possibility space of what can happen in that domain so that you can take actuality spaces of things that are actually happening, and then you can map them together. And then when you do that, you can better operate on that system, like whatever it is you're trying to operate on. So I think it's the same thing with interdisciplinarity, except, you know, now we're trying to find consilience between two disparate domains and see how they fit together. And then we can use them in conjunction for joint problem solving. And it's similar on the transdisciplinary scale, where people try and wrap their arms around everything and bring that all in and try and solve for complex problems. And so archdisciplinarity is just a further advancement on that. Now we're just taking all the different ways that people have brought everything together into some kind of consilient unification framework. And we're doing comparative studies on the different ways that people have done it and trying to say some things that are common across the different approaches. And so when you're asking me before about, like, you know, what are some of like the things that come out of this is the identification of arches. And so arches are universal archetypal patterns of nature that appear to persist across these big picture theory of everything frameworks. Certain properties and categories of properties that super smart people use to organize and put everything into arrangement, everything that people understand. And there's a lot of different ways that people do it, but these, even though people have different expressions for how they go about orienting things, there's still these similar repeating underlying patterns.
Is there a way you could give me an example of one of these patterns?
Yeah, so the one that I would start out on would be universal computability. So normally when people think about computation, they think about computers, and then they get angry because, you know, somebody is comparing people to computers, but we're not computers. We're like living, breathing creatures. And that's true. And I agree that with that. But there's a different quality to what is meant here when I say universal computability. I'm making reference to the way that people tended to use the term before we had computational machines, and then that knowledge being used as the basis for constructing computational machines. So the way that people were understanding computation earlier on informed the technologies. So by universal computability, I mean that there are entities that exist, and then they have relationships, and then there are relationships within the relationships, and it creates a system. And then that system becomes a new kind of entity. And then the process recurses, it repeats. And so we can see this repeating pattern across any given domain of human knowledge. For example, in matter, there are substances, forces, and configurations. So you have entities, you have relationships between entities, and then you have systems, these configurations. And then the configuration becomes a new substance, and then the process repeats. And this creates an increase in complexity of the building blocks of the physical universe. We also see the same thing in life. Our cells have relationships with other cells, and then they form a higher level of organization. So you have like anatomical units, you have animation between units, and then it forms a higher level of organization. And then that organization becomes a new kind of a unit, becomes a new kind of an entity, that has relationships with other entities, that creates an even higher level of organization. So you can see this, you know, from cells to tissues to organs to whole organisms to the relationship between organisms in ecosystems. And another example I would give is in semiotics, like in meaning. Like, we have units of meaning, we have semantic units, and then we syntactically relate them. And then this creates an overall pragmatic. And then that pragmatic has a new kind of a meaning that has sort of compounded everything in which it's composed, which we then use as a new unit to relate to other units, and so on and so forth. So universe computability is one of those arches that we see show up across these different frameworks. For example, like, so I would use examples that probably the audience would be most familiar with. Like, for example, integral theory is quite popular. He has this whole notion of holons. This is what holons are. Holons are things that are made up of smaller parts, and then they themselves make up larger parts. We can also take a look at Greg Henriquez's Unified Theory of Knowledge. He has a framework of it's the table of behavior, where he basically describes like units, parts, and relations and systems. He has like a similar notion of it, periodic table of behavior. That's what it's called. So yeah, those would be some examples.
Wow. Yeah. Okay. So you've come down to the you're trying to find the simplest common denominator in this whole issue of computability. So if I were thinking of the writing of music as a example of universal computability, in that case, you have to have a composer. So then, is the composer the entity, or are the notes the entity?
Well, I would say both. Like, you have an entity that's operating on the world, performing computational functions. I mean, I'm not an expert in music, but you know, you have notes, which are the entities, and then there's some sort of syntax in terms of like how they're related in a sequence. And then you get a measure, and then the measure is the sort of systematization of all the notes together to play a piece of music. And then you have different instruments that play different notes in conjunction with each other. And so now you get this higher level of organization, where you get people in a rock band, where you get people, you know, having different lines in their digital creation of music, in their programs, or you have, you know, symphonies that come together and play something.
Yeah, we've talked quite a lot about that particular computational system because it seems to make a good example of the way the different levels are nested inside of each other.
Mm-hmm.
And so where do algorithms come in this picture? Is the algorithm what's making the relations, or?
Well, I don't know. That's a good question. I mean, the way that I think about algorithms in relationship to universal computability would to say that there's like forward and backwards computation. So like, when things run forward, things are assembling, they're coming together into a larger whole. And then when you run computation backwards, then things are breaking down into their parts. So you could, for example, relate this to like thinking, you know, like you're constructing a more complex idea, or you're, you know, synthesizing, or you're analyzing, you're breaking things down into parts. And I think that people use both of them, right? Like, if you're trying to understand a complicated problem, first you want to figure out what all the elements are. You want to break them down into their parts and understand how they work. And then you want to combine them, reassemble them into something more complex. So I think that there's like a, like when you take like universal computability to behaviorism and developmental psychology, like there are frameworks that describe transitions as people go from like one stage of behavioral complexity to the next. So two of them that I would like to use as examples is the model of hierarchical complexity and dynamic skill theory. First being from Michael Lamport-Commons, who I was lucky enough to have as a a mentor and advisor when I did my master's. And the other is from Kurt Fischer, who's in the brain mind. He ran the brain mind science department at Harvard. Actually, both of them worked at Harvard. So to speak to this notion of algorithm, and the model of hierarchical complexity between stages is described something called transition dynamics. And what transition dynamics describe is each incremental transition step as someone goes from one behavioral form to another behavioral form. And the way it works is that a person has a certain way of thinking or doing or feeling, just a way of behaving, and then something new gets introduced into that space. When something gets introduced into that space, it can create destabilization because you have your way of doing things, and now there's this other way of thinking and doing and feeling. So generally, what people will do is they'll either be super contrary to it and just like reject it right away because it's not the way that they already are. Or if people continue along this trajectory, they will say, okay, so maybe the way that I'm thinking and feeling and doing things doesn't solve for everything, and this other way is also useful. And then this causes an oscillation. So people will do one way of thinking or doing or feeling or behaving in one case, and they'll do the other in the other case, but they can't quite reconcile how both can exist in the same space. They just kind of take it as a given. But if a person continues their development, eventually they'll do that thing I described before, where they'll say, all right, I'm going to break these things down a little bit and look at them in more detail, and then reassemble them back up and then fit them together. And then when they're able to do that, they're able to reach a more complex behavioral form. So like a really basic example is like a kid trying to figure out how to ride a bicycle, right? It's like you have your sensory motor and you have your representation and you're doing this coordination to coordinate your representation of what you want to happen with what's going on in your sensory motor system. And so sometimes you'll kind of like, the kid will lean one too far to one side or too far to the other, and we put training wheels on. But eventually there's this equilibrium that's established. They create this intermeshing between these different systems in themselves to create that balance, which I think is associated with, what is it called, like equilibrioception. So another example is if we're in a relationship with another person, whether it's a friend or a partner or someone who has differences in politics, there's like different people have different points of view. And in order for us to do the democratic process, we listen to what both persons have to say or both parties have to say. And then we drill down into the components of like why they like what motivates them for having it, what their real deep needs are. And then we try and come back and reconstruct something together that, you know, both sides can agree on, a higher level of equilibrium. I think this is like basically what democracy is supposed to do, right? It's like you have like different parties, and then they sit down and they talk out their differences to find some sort of like higher order resolve that can be satisfiable to everybody.
And that's one thing my husband is always talking about. He immigrated to this country from Hong Kong when he was 10 or 11 years old. And whenever I start complaining about how polarized we are as a nation, he says, you should always be thankful that there are two parties because that's the way that you can finally get at the truth. You know, even if our system isn't doing it like they ought to in terms of talking to each other. But that is where the opportunity for growth lies is in really trying to understand, I think, what it is that each party has as their ultimate goal. I mean, I'm a little bit of a softie. I tend to think that everybody wants the best for people. We just have different ways of approaching to find a solution for what's the best for people. I mean, some people think that there are more malevolent forces at work, but it's easier for me to believe the best and to just try to understand what the policies are that people hope to bring about the best for other people. So,
I'd like to say some more words on the politics thing, and I think I can say some things that can be generally agreeable by both sides. I hope. So people who are conservative tend to want to preserve the equilibrium that they already have. And people who are progressive want to continue developing. They want to find new ways to integrate new things and come up with better ways. And there's a certain polarization there. And I think there's like a healthy version of it, right? It's like we want to maintain our equilibriums insofar as they work, but we also need to be open to change when what we're doing isn't working anymore. And so I think like in the political spectrum of this sort of thing, having two parties that are polarized on that matter, well, I think it's good to have different people who have different perspectives and are bringing in different things. Because like if we lean too far into just being conservative, then we wouldn't develop the resilience we need to encounter and deal with the problems that we face as societies. But if we are too progressive and we develop too fast, we're not able to keep up with the consequences of what we create, and we're not always able to think through the implications of the consequences of making those changes. I think we can say that without polarizing too much on one side or the other, but just acknowledging that both sides actually have important values that they bring to the table. And the path forward really is getting back to the sitting down. Everyone sits down at the table and works out their problems, like strategizing together instead of strategizing against each other. But I'm sure a lot more could be said, and probably a lot of people who are watching this probably have some caveats to that, which I think are probably important also to bring to that table.
Yeah, I think that's a beautiful idea. For me, the first election that I took interest in was in 1960. So I've watched a lot of elections, and I was in junior high school back then. And I started getting interested enough in politics that I was stuffing envelopes and things like that. The biggest change that I've noticed over the years is that back then, the people in the two parties, even though a person might be in a particular party, there were a lot of diversity of ideas within each party. And over time, it seems like people have more and more siloed themselves into a particular ideology in both parties. So if you start talking to somebody who is a proclaimed conservative, somebody who's out and proud about being a conservative, or somebody who's out and proud about being a progressive, you can almost just, without them even opening their mouth, you can say, well, you believe this and this and this and this and this and this and this, and you're angry about this and this and this. And you don't even have to have the conversation, because people have siloed themselves inside of rigid ideologies. And to me, that's the saddest thing, because there's no conversation left then. You can't have a conversation about potential shifts of ideas or where the new ideas might come from, because everything has to fit inside your box. And I don't know if it is social media that has completely brought that about, but I also think it was a shift in the way that even television and radio news started doing their thing. When they, back in the, I think it was the 1980s or 1990s, they started having these argumentative in-your-face debates on TV. And people would get locked in like you become a fan of one boxer or the other boxer, and they're battling it out like that. And that doesn't seem to lead to answers. And we certainly find that in all of these other models. Like you were just talking about the model of hierarchical complexity. And you said something comes in that destabilizes. Would that, now, I think I, when you and I had our pre-call, I talked to you a bit about the idea of anomaly. And it seems to me that that's where anomaly comes in, this little bit of a destabilizing element.
Yeah, I think it's actually a, I mean, I'm just kind of talking up cuff here, but I would think of anomaly as sort of like a necessary, like transcendental function of nature. It's sort of like pushes everything to keep its progress. But
love
to
that.
Say that
you said a necessary transcendental function of nature. I love
But to
that.
say that, it leans a little
Can
bit
I
into
steal
the
that?
progressive side, but what's that?
Can I steal that? I mean, I just call it a gift, but it sounds so much more sciencey to say a fundamental, a necessary transcendental function of nature.
Well, nature likes equilibriums, but nature also likes to continue evolving. So, and one more thing on the political thing, today's conservatism was yesterday's progressivism. So, for us to have a progressive movement now, we'll eventually arrive at a point where the people who have managed to establish that will then be conservative to maintain that, and then there will be a new progressive, right? So I think in the context of thinking about arches, it's the whole idea of understanding universal forms that repeat over and over again that gives us a context to understand on both the small scale and the large scale what's going on, so that we can sort of locate where we are and have some sense about where things are going. And if you kind of know what's already going to happen in the future, even if you don't know the exact instantiated expression of it, then I think it can inform us for better decision making now. And I wouldn't propose to know what that looks like for one person or the next. I'm just talking about these arches, these universal patterns themselves that seem to persist, which themselves are, an approximation. And I'm sure that as time goes on, we'll get better at understanding what they are and how they work. But I think, for what we talk about in the book, we're sort of presenting as a contribution to human understanding, what some of these things seem to be, which we can then, have conversations about and build better ideas on. Build better ideas about. Mean, that's what science does, right? It's like you make propositions, you put forth hypotheses, and people test them out. And if they hold, they become a theory. And they seem to hold. And there's plenty of evidence in the book for it. So maybe they've graduated to theory, but it's like putting these things forth in the world so other people can take a look and then verify it themselves and come back and have conversations, and we can all sort of together come to better understandings about how ourselves, the world, and the universe works.
Would you say that the scientific process is a kind of universal computability pattern?
Yeah, I would say universal computability isn't anything, really. I mean, you base in science, you're basically making with a hypothesis, you're making a future projection. So you're saying at the end of this systematization, there's going to be this outcome, and then you test it. Like you run an experiment, and it can look wildly different from one approach to the next. But you perform it, and you keep track of everything you do, so then you can show it to other people, and then they can do it themselves and see if they come to the same conclusion following the same method.
Well, so the way that I thought for a long time about the whole process of painting, of instantiating a vision in the process of painting, recently I had started to think it's actually no different than the scientific process in many ways, because you're positing a theory, you're then running the experiment, and then at the end you see whether or not the theory stands up to the original claim. When you're painting a painting, you have a vision and then you run the process. And at the end, is it representing that vision or is it not? And usually not, because the vision always outruns the skill. So in order to get to the vision, you have to take a look and say, what skills do I need to develop now? Begin to develop those skills, and then you run the whole process again. And then I started to think, well, that's no different than the way we live our lives. I have to make a decision. What am I going to do in the next step? I have to try something. I don't know if it's going to work or not work. I mean, every move that we make in life, we don't know if it's going to have a good result or a bad result. So you run the process, then you take a look. Did this have a good result or not? And so it all seems to be the same pattern. So when you start talking about this as universal computability, it totally makes sense to me.
Yeah, I'll sort of like maybe give some context to like how I'm thinking about it, and then say some words if I can remember. I don't monologue too long and forget what I was trying to say. So, like in academia, there's different ways that people divide up human endeavors, like in the scholarly context. And I don't even know if scholarly is the right word, but just, like different pursuits that people have. I think it goes something like the one that people most use. I think it goes something like there's like natural sciences, formal sciences, social sciences, applied sciences, and humanities. And sometimes people divide up natural science a bit because you have like, the physical sciences and life sciences and things like that. But in the humanities is usually where people put art, right? And art is basically like I'm sure there's a lot of different ways we could explain it, or like also sort of like cut that pie up. But one of the lenses I find useful is thinking about it in terms of like utility versus aesthetic. And so there's like the practicality of creating something. So it fulfills some sort of like special purpose for some end. And then the aesthetic is purely for the qualitative positive experience of the thing, or being able to create like some kind of experience itself. It's paying attention to experience itself. But like these kinds of like what I just described for like these different domains in academia, they're like conventional categories of knowledge. So we have like this whole history of the development of human understanding, and you get a lot of people who have a lot of different ideas, and then they sort of just people try and like group things together in some way, some semblance. But there's a lot more in common across these different domains than I think people give credit for. We could take any of those as a starting point and relate it to any of the other ones to find the relationships. But like if we're going to take art as that example, like okay, so in science, like what are you doing but like creating some sort of utility structure to better understand how things work? Like there's a similar underlying form there that is the same as just painting a picture, right? And of course there are going to be differences, but we're talking about like something more fundamental to being human, that takes on a variation of expressions, even though it's just fundamentally the same thing. And I would say like universal computability as an arch, I would say it like has associations with it because we're taking things, we're relating them together, and we're creating something more complex. And it's pretty amazing the diversity of different ways that we can do it. But I'll carry something else over, which is like aesthetics. So like a person does science and they, demonstrate something and then they put it out into the world. But if you can't wrap it in some sort of aesthetic that's appealing to people, then it's really hard to get people to grok what it is that you're trying to say, right? So people will like come up with illustrations, both like figurative and metaphorically speaking. To be able to communicate ideas, to be able to get through to people, to relate it to things that people already understand, to transfer the importance of what it is that they're contributing. So, yeah, I think that I think there's a lot of relationships between different domains of human inquiry, just on account of the fundamental human nature of like what it means to be a person in the world and operate on ourselves and on life.
Yeah, so when I'm making a painting, you have the initial vision, what it is I'm going to paint. Maybe it's just in my head, or maybe I've got a photograph, or maybe I'm looking at a scene out in the world, and I put a stroke down on the canvas, and then begins this process of computation, because I'm looking at that stroke, and somehow I can assess And it's the somehow that's very important, because there's a whole lot of stuff behind that somehow. But somehow I can assess, is it in the right place? Is it the right color? Well, what do I mean, right? Well, is it contributing to the vision? Is it contributing to making the thing that I need to make in that space? So there's a measurement going on, a kind of a judgment that goes on with each stroke. And then the next stroke has to be related to that stroke. And it has to also be related to what's going on inside of me in this whole process of judging and measuring. And so as the strokes go on, not only are you building something on the canvas that is all relate, all the pieces are related together and all the pieces are related to this original vision, but the thing that you're building on the canvas now has a context, and every new stroke changes the context. So the context that's already there, you lay down the next stroke, and that's changing the measurement. And I think that's the pattern that's happening with scientific exploration. That's the pattern that's happening as we live our lives, because every step that we take changes the context. Just like they say, no child is ever born into the same home. If there are many children in a family, every one of the kids has a completely different context that they're born into. So I think that whole issue of context is really important.
Yeah, so first thing that comes to mind is so when talking about universal computability, you have entity relations and systems, but there's also this other characteristic to it, which is recursivity. So it's like this self referential process, right? So like you do a thing, it comes back to you, and then you observe, and then it updates your sense. And then you do something else, and then it recurses and comes
Exactly.
back. I mean, this is like, literally built into our bodies. Like every single second, our brains have this onslaught of information that's being, absorbed by our senses. And I mean, you can try and like quantify all, like, take a time period and slice it up into increments, but it's like this sort of like smooth series of our experience in every millisecond updating, across that time series to formalize some semblance of recognition. And so this is like fractal, like it's gonna apply to anything and everything that we do in any given moment. And the other thing that came to mind was, I could see like, I'm not being antithetical to what you say here. I could see other people, some people saying, yeah, but like when I do art, I just sit and I just start doing things and it just sort of comes out of me. And I think that's true also, but that can get carried over into science as well. I mean, how many times have we, I can't think of like an example off the top of my head, but I'm sure we've all heard of an example where someone, they're like, I was just taking a bath and suddenly I had this epiphany about how this thing worked. What is it that somebody did that? Like they literally like what was in a bath and then they saw the water.
Archimedes. That was Archimedes.
Yeah,
Eureka.
so it's like
You might be, the urban legend is he went running out into the street naked. Eureka, Eureka. It had something to do with the displacement of an object in water.
yes,
Yeah.
yeah. The point being here, it's just, I think that like intuitions can, be in both places as well, right? Like.
Well, in terms of people who say they're just the art just comes out of them. I can understand that from the standpoint of sometimes you can get into a flow state and you can finish a painting and you look at it and it's like, where did that even come from? I don't even have any, except that I know that even in a flow state, that because of our conscious and our subconscious always working, that there's something that is causing you to pick up that other color or to mix these colors together and to make that color and to apply that. There's something that's going on there and then the other thing that is lying underneath all of that, that I think is, I'm guessing also lies underneath your arches, or maybe is some of your arches, is that part of what's going on in our subconscious that we're not even aware of is we are, th there are a system of principles that kind of govern what makes something beautiful or makes something, I'll just use the word beautiful, make something beautiful. And that is it harmonious? Is it unified? Is there a contrast that catches the eye? Is there repetition? Is there variation and gradation and balance? And these things naturally show up in works of art that are captivating. If you can walk by a piece of art in a museum and not even glance at it, then those things probably aren't going on. But if there's something that draws your eye and captivates you, then those things are definitely in that painting. Maybe the artist wasn't conscious of putting them in, but they're there because that is what draws the eye. And that's been observed over the centuries and categorized and taught to people now. But, 1,000 years ago, they probably weren't teaching that explicitly, but it was still showing up in the work. So, I think that that kind of thing is also underneath all of these sciences and psychology and what you were saying about computability and the progression of time. That's one of the things I love about Wolfram's picture. Whether his picture is true or not true, it's a beautiful picture of thinking of space consisting of all of these unique particles being affected by this constant updating of time, because we're conscious of that as human beings. I mean, they'll try to say to us, oh, well, time doesn't exist, but we are conscious of that movement of the updating of time.
Okay, so I'm just going to back up a little bit. So I think also part of what attracts people to art is the behavioral forms that underpin it. And also, like, of course, the content of it. If it reflects something like certain values a person has, and I mean that in a very generalized way. So like if one looks at like the history of art, so I'm not an art historian. Okay, so I'm putting a disclaimer out there, but I know a little bit about it, just being, a generalist. So historically, my understanding is that art was primarily religious. So like when people were doing art, they were painting religious images. And that's not, true for all cases, but for most of the cases. It's not until like the last couple hundred years when art leaned more into the aesthetic in terms of like people just painting for the pleasure of painting. And I think part of that was probably because of like the economic development, like people just didn't have a lot of time or money to spend on, practicing something that didn't feed their family. I'm thinking, like the last 100 years, like for example, so just thinking about developmental psychology and thinking about art, and then thinking about how art can sometimes reflect the way that people think in a society in a way, like this notion that sometimes new ideas will come out in art before they come out in other forms of expression, because mm-hmm. there's like the artist is sort of connected to their unconscious in a way, and they're able to allow things to come out of them more fluidly than if you're trying to like write a technical book about how something in the world works. So like I think about like abstract painting, and then I think about like the abstract stage of in developmental psychology. Like there's a lot of models, and there are many of them that describe like abstract stage, which is like, quantifications and generalizations and understanding, how things can overlap and share properties, but, be their own classes and things like that. And then I think about like Picasso, one of the few artists that I could probably just remember right now. But like, Picasso's work, it's all about perspective. So like you know, as civilization around him was developing into understanding how to look at things from different perspectives and combine them together, then we have like an artist such as himself that like draws these paintings where you see different sides of a person all simultaneously. So I think art can also reflect not just the individual, but also like this sort of like unconscious development that a society is going through. I used to get High Fructose. It's like this this magazine, and then they would have like all these interesting art styles, and I would reflect on them, just amazed like how many unique styles people could come up with. But then also reflecting on them from like a developmental psychology lens, in their symbolic representation of like what they represent about different ways that people can be and express things that have like an artistic expression, but maybe it comes out in other domains of life in different ways.
Yeah, that's a very interesting path to go down. But the whole, I didn't want to drive the whole conversation towards art. I'm trying to make a relationship with the archdisciplinarity concept. And the last thing I'm going to say about art, and I think that this is representative of all these arches, not just of art, is this idea that Dorothy Sayers had that she wrote in The Mind of the Maker, where she talks about the idea, the energy, and the power. So in your framework of universal computability, it would be the entity, the relations, and the system. And you were talking about when something is made in a commercial sector, like the development of the iPhone, for example. You have the idea, you know, we need this thing. And then all the energy is the design work, the process of manufacturing, and all of that energy goes into producing this iPhone. And at the end, you have the iPhone. Now, the power is the power that object has in the world, the way that people relate to it, their perspective about it, their opinions about it, how it might influence them. That's the power. So, and maybe that's a different arch than universal computability, but I do definitely think it's an arch that shows up everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're along the same lines. You know, it's a variation of expression of a similar idea. And that's like the whole point of arches is to, you know, try and boil down the most essential features of a thing or of things in general, like how things work. But once you have that, then to make it useful, you have to convert it into something tangible, right? Like real world, you know, on the ground things. So I think like what you're describing is like a really good example of how we can do this.
Well, let's take a look at some of the other things on your list after universal computability. Can you see this page?
Yeah.
Okay, maybe I can make it a little bit bigger.
Yeah, and so I'll just take this as a moment to say, so Foundations of Archdisciplinarity, we released it a year ago as a first edition. So anybody who's watching, who's interested, you could go to our website, arc.voyage, and you can get like the free edition of it. Something that we talked about that we want to do is like whenever we're going to be releasing a book, we want to release like a free version that has like a lot of the core ideas in it, and then also release a physical publication, which goes into more depth. So people who are actually really interested have something that they can dive their teeth into, and also we can generate revenue for our organization that way. So Foundations of Archdisciplinarity, the book that we're looking at now, this is like from the new stuff. So the second edition basically doubles the size of the previous one. And the additional stuff we added is all about arches, their relations, and how they can get systematized with like a bunch of examples of how it applies to real world things. And so yeah, this page here is I think this is pretty much near like the beginning of like the new stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, well, I'm actually quite eager to see the next edition, because that was the thing I was missing, was examples in the first go round. Because I think examples will bring it to life. You know, stories are what engage people with ideas. So yeah, having some stories and some examples would be very helpful. So the next thing after universal computation is complexity. So what can we learn about that?
So complexity basically, they are complexity is like different dimensions of what happens in universal computational space. So here, like we use horizontal, vertical, and diagonal, but we don't mean them necessarily like in physical, tangible space, like how we think about them. I'll just give some description so it kind of makes sense. So horizontal complexity is like how many bits or how many entities or how many relations or how many systems exist at a particular level in the assembly of the construction of things. Vertical complexity describes that verticality where, so with horizontal complexity, for example, you'll have like a multiplicity of elements, and so you can enumerate like how many that there are, and you can account for them on that level. And then with vertical complexity, that's where the transition dynamics I described before take place, where things combine into more complex things, and then they become units that combine with other units into more complex things. So that's the vertical line. In the diagonal line, diagonal complexity is basically where you get the output of a universal computation, and then it becomes the input of another universal computation that is, or I'll just say another computation that is not directly above or below in the stack. So an example of that would be like, so in the construction of a paradigm, which consists of principles that hold for abstract systems, you can take the paradigms, but you can use a lower stage behavior to count them. So you can be like, oh, we have, you know, one, two, three. There's three paradigms. So diagonal complexity is perhaps using a lower behavioral form to coordinate a higher behavioral form. And complexity is basically, well, to explain complexity more, I would need to talk about the other arches, so I'll stop there for a moment.
Well, we did quite a few episodes on this channel early on the difference between complicated and complex. Does that come into this?
Well, I mean, different people have different ways that they use language. I don't make a distinction, but I'm open to hear like what some ideas are in terms of their differences.
Well, complicated would be, for example, like my watch is complicated. It has a lot of parts. But if you put the parts together the same way every time, you're going to get the same watch, even though it's complicated. It might be difficult. It's complicated. But something that is complex, can have unexpected variability. I might be saying this wrong, but I think chaos theory and complexity theory kind of jump into this other arena that goes beyond complicated.
Yeah, so I think like on so if we're taking complexity and then we're having so sort of a polarity between simplicity and complicatedness, then we're talking about enumeration, like how many elements are involved. And as we know, like people can only keep track of like so many things at one time. I think it's like somewhere between four and seven average person. And then when you start going beyond that, then you have to do special mind tricks to like remember. But yeah, I would sort of like position it like that. So if we think about like, so you have units that are having relationships with other units, and then they're forming system, they're intermeshing together, forming a system. So if you have a low number of elements that are composed of the system, then we could say that system is simple. But when you the problem is that when you start having those elements relating to other elements, and then they combine into something more complex, and you get another stack and another stack, I think that's where the complicatedness starts to come in, because there gets to be so many things going on, so many moving parts, that it's hard for us to keep track of everything going on at one time. Now, in developmental psychology, basically, you have different stages of behavior, and the stages are associated with how many nests that a person can coordinate, right? So, like, if we're talking about coordinating paradigm, then you have to be able to coordinate the principles. You have to understand how the principles are associated with abstract systems of representation about concrete real world things. And then about those concrete real world things, their own interiorities. So it creates multiple nests of coordination an individual has to do to be able to comprehend everything that goes into that area, which is why it takes people years to like develop understanding. However, insofar as we understand like universal general procedures or the general algorithm for constructing that intelligence, then we can reflect on that and align how we understand intelligence with our own intelligence, which then makes it easier for us to coordinate more nests. But you know, there's like a genetic component to it as well, which is that, you know, some people are just better at doing math than other people. Like the parietal sulcus part of the brain you do calculations with is just they have more brain matter there than another person. So at the same time, I think that there's, you know, we have to have some understanding that not everybody's brains can do everything perfectly and exactly the same way, but I think like just in general, the universal procedure is going to be the same, like across domains. It's going to be the same universal computational procedure to get from one stage to the next. So complexity helps us organize the elements that go into a computation, how many stacks of computation there is. And when someone comes out somewhere and then they plug it in to some other stage that's not directly related. And then we can get really clear about, we can get like we can map out a general space and be really clear where we are. And then if we get stuck, then we can articulate exactly where we're stuck in the transitions, which then can help us unwedge our stuckness. You know, have some idea of where we would be going next. And then that can inspire us to, you know, fill it in with whatever that immediate context might need.
I can see it would be helpful with education, particularly. My husband is a person who's very motivated to learn when he needs to learn something new for a new task. So in his career, he's worked at a number of different companies, all basically in the tech arena, but in different spheres of the tech arena. And whenever he's, you know, either by, we've had a lot of downturns in the tech sector. So sometimes it's a layoff, sometimes it's a decision to move from a company that's not doing that well to another company. Whenever he's moved from one company to another, he gets a book about that new technology and he reads that book in a few days and then he goes in for the interview. But I think it's because of the trajectory of stacking one domain on top of another domain in a reasonable order that when he reads the new book, it fits in with everything that he's learned before that. So he's kind of built up a matrix of knowledge so that any new knowledge that comes in has a place to plug in. And so it's this continual plugging in of new knowledge on this stack, which if you're just sort of, I think that's one of the problems with YouTube is it's easy to just randomly jump from this thing to that thing. Things don't have any place to plug in because you haven't built an adequate foundation before you do this. So this whole issue of horizontal, vertical, and diagonal complexity would give you some idea of how to set those plugins so that you've built the foundation first.
Yeah, I think most people in the world don't really understand developmental psychology. And understanding developmental psychology is a prerequisite to understanding intelligence because every mental behavior that we have follows developmental psychology rules and they exhibit developmental psychology stages. And there's, you know, there's domain-specific developmental psychologies that describe different stages that people go through in a specific domain. But there are also like domain general developmental psychological models that describe, human intelligence and how it grows across domains in similar ways. And in terms of this, we're talking about underlying properties that will persist across different developmental psychology frameworks, both the domain specific and the domain general ones. And like when I was talking about hierarchical complexity, and then I mentioned dynamic skill theory, but I didn't get into it, like those are domain general. Those are domain general frameworks. So I would say like anyone interested in like big picture thinking should take a really close look at developmental psychology. It will just make you smarter, like reading it, because you can locate where you're at in your own development in the domain, and then you can see, you can match like where you came from. You can be like, I remember when I was like that, and then you can see what comes next, and you're like, okay, I don't know how to do that yet, but now I have a description of what it is and how it works, and now it gives me kind of a roadmap to practice getting there.
Cool. Well, so let's move on to fractality. We talk a lot about fractality in this corner of the internet, primarily because of Jonathan Pageau and his discussion of symbols, symbolic thinking. But how does fractality fit into this right now? So all of these things that we're looking at here are part of the arch of computability. Is that correct?
These are all individually arches,
Oh,
but
okay.
they
So
all are related and then they are systematized together.
okay. Well, so fracticality is another arch. So let's look at that. Give us some examples.
So, for anybody who doesn't know what a fractal is, it's a self-similar form. So the way that people do like fractals in mathematics and geometry is they basically will look at a shape that has self-similarity in it, and then they'll measure. So they'll measure the length, and then they'll measure how far it is where the self-similarity repeats in the structure, and then they get like a fraction. So with fractals, there's like the quantitative side of it, but on the other hand, there's a qualitative side to fractals as well. And the quantitative and the qualitative is what I refer to as qua, about fracticality. It's a property that comes out of fracticality. The qualitative side of fractals is, remember how earlier I was talking about, oh, we can look at matter and there's like substance forces and configurations and then it repeats over and over again. Well, that's a fractal. And if you look at like the building blocks of life, how you have like anatomical units that animate into high levels of organization over and over and over again, following the same procedure, that's a fractal. So these are qualitative fractals where you have this triplication that repeats over and over and over again of this universal computability. And so when we look across the diversity of all these different quantitative and qualitative fractals that exist in nature. And also, I'll add as well, because of what you had said before about symbols, like semantics, syntactics, and pragmatics. And then it stacks to create more complex meaning in the semiotic domain. So when we, there's also some, the characteristic of morphism, which basically says that there's also a certain shape, and that shape can be quantitative, qualitative, or some synthesis of both. And I would argue that usually it's a synthesis of both. But you get like a general form, and then that form is what is self-similar. So the importance of this notion of morphism is that it allows us to see how complex patterns repeat over and over again to sort of like extract what this generalized universal characteristic is. And of course there's a whole gradation of variations of morphisms, but like the most universal morphisms that we propose in the book are arches, that these things will show up everywhere. They just take different expressions because it's like, you know, you get different combinations of different things in different ways, and then there's just this combinatoric explosion of possibility of things that can happen. But like all the way underneath at the most fundamental level, these properties repeat over and over again. So I would say that we can apply fractality to any of the arches, and they'll all be expressions of morphisms, like universal morphisms.
So an example would of a quantitative morphism would be let's say the Fibonacci sequence. And then the qualitative aspect of that would be the golden mean, or the way that the Fibonacci sequence shows up in different living things like pine cones and pineapples and
But also in the dis like the structure of a pine cone, it's going to have anatomical units that are in relation, form systems, and in the building blocks of that organismic component. So fractality is both, like it's both things simultaneously, both the qualitative and the quantitative. And for whatever reason, people have just sort of like glanced over the qualitative. But I think we have a lot of evidence for it in this book, and there's plenty of sections where we discuss how fractality shows up in matter, life, and mind.
Great. Well, we probably have time for one more, maybe one more thing. And boundaries is a big thing in my world. So let's take a look at boundaries.
So permeative boundaries basically says that, like, whenever you have a complete computation, and then you get a new whole, like a new entity, that there's it creates this boundary space. So whenever that happens, then it creates an interiority, and then it has an exteriority to everything that isn't in the immediately intermeshing of that space. So asking, like, where it started, that's sort of like a metaphysical notion that I'm not even sure the answer for, but we can at least look at what is, we can observe, and we can see that this shows up everywhere. So wherever an object is separated from anything else, it expresses like permeative boundaries. So how the boundaries actually happen, I could relate to universal computability as well. So, like, if you have, like, an object, it has exteriority and it has a bounded space in its interior, and then it comes into contact with other objects at that same in that same horizontal space. But then, if they intermesh, then they start sharing their interiorities, and then that's what causes a new kind of boundary to be created. But the boundaries that each element has still maintains, at least in most cases, like it'll maintain to a degree. So, and that way we can still make a distinction between cells, even though they make up tissues, or we can make a distinction between tissues, even though they're making up organs. But there's a certain kind of a nestedness that happens, and where something is considered interior and exterior can change depending on what level of building blocks that one is at. And when we're talking about, like, developmental psychology and people developing increasingly more complex behavioral forms, it's not just for like architectures of building blocks of nature, but it's also like for processes as well. There's like a certain process space of like what's being allowed into a particular coordination, and then those coordination spaces get conjoined with other coordination spaces, and then that gets conjoined at a more complex level. Now that the transjectivity, it's kind of interesting to me because John Verbeke and I both seem to have coined it at the same time, but we didn't know about each other. And our ideas are kind of similar, but they're a little bit different. I place transjectivity as, I got my notions from Niculescu, which is the notion of the included middle. So you have objects, and and then their interior subjectivity in relationship to each other, but there are also properties of nature that pervade both the interior and exterior of objects and subjects. So things like, so examples of this would be things like time, space, and energy. They persist, their properties persist. And no matter how many integrative levels of building blocks you go, these transjective characteristics will persist. So that, I think, is a kind of a summary of what permeation boundaries is about.
Um, Well, I have a couple questions about that. First of all, you said you got the idea of transjectivity from Niculescu. How do you spell that?
I think it's Niculescu. Maybe.
Okay. So he's a
I kind of have a problem with language sometimes, so pardon me if I'm.
Niculescu was a current recent scientist or ancient
He's
or
retired. He's retired.
okay.
I briefly talked to him. No, but yeah, like he's retired.
Okay, and so say again what you mean transjectivity. It says here it's a cross perturbation space throughout interior and exterior spaces of entity, action, and system. So
It's the character.
what exactly does that mean?
So, space underpins all objects and subjects. It's a pervading property that persists, and it holds the whole universe in itself. So this would be transjective. So space exists in you, it exists inside and underneath me. Everything around us is the pure potentiality and possibility for anything and everything to actualize. This would constitute an example of what is meant by transjectivity. It's exactly the same everywhere, and it is through it that it allows anything to exist at all. We could say the same thing about energy. Energy is another universal class, like space, which is the pure being, and all objects and subjects share the same underlying energy. It's just transforming in different ways and taking different expressions. And nature doesn't waste anything. So, when a particular formalization of energy disperses in the sort of like entropy, negentropy kind of context, then it just gets absorbed by all the other systems around it. Like there's no separation between different increments of energy. Everything is just a smooth permeation of pure being, which takes expression in different big picture frameworks in different ways, and then we can go back like historically into like religious notions of this sort of thing.
So when John Verbeke talks about transjectivity, he's more talking about the space that opens up between two people and connects their subjectivity, or is a kind of space in between the subjectivity and objectivity of something. You're talking about transjectivity as being more fundamental, is more like a common frame for all entities.
I would say that, I would say his expression is similar, but it's more specific to like human affairs. Whereas like what we're talking about here, we're talking about like cosmic, universal, archetypal patterns of nature that persists not just in human affairs, but it persists independent of us in and across everything.
Well, I mean, that's what I think is kind of interesting about your book is that what I've always sort of intuited is that there's a scale invariance to everything, and that a truth that you find in any particular domain, if it's truly true, you're going to find that same truth in all the other domains, and that in that sense, truth is completely scale invariant, and you can find a particular way of looking at things in the human realm, and you can drive right down to the cell level and find that same thing going on among cells. And likewise, you can find something that goes on among cells, and then you go, oh yeah, I've seen that over here in this other domain of knowledge. So that's one of the very interesting things about truth, I think. So
I would say, like, so there's that, somebody can ask the question, well, why? Like, why write this book? What is the like functional usefulness of any of these things? And to that, I would say the entire evolution of human understanding is to create as symmetrical as possible representation in our mind that matches reality, matches the world. And as we went through this evolution, we increase our resolution of detail. And I don't know if I had said this to you when we had a pre-call, but it's this thing I'll say when this comes up, which is like we basically started like 480p and now we're like 8K, and we're going to keep getting higher and higher resolutions of detail as we go. So in the world, what is life but confronting complex challenges and then learning to overcome them? But then once we overcome that, then new challenges come to us and then we overcome those. So it's this constant process of coordinating differences and creating higher, more complex equilibriums, and trying to find increasingly more satisfiable ways of being and doing in the world. And so, of course, now we're at this stage of globalization on our planet. So we can talk about like local issues that we have, like as human beings in our lives, the challenges that we face in ourselves, in relation to other people, in our environments, in our cultures, in our societies, as a nation, and then across the entire anthroposphere. So there's this question, like, are there things that we can understand that are universal? And if we can understand those universal things, can it help us universally problem solve across any given domain? And we're facing a lot of like super complicated, really dangerous challenges on a global level that we need to figure out ways to work out. And yeah, I think things are getting better. Like we're coming up with a lot of ways to make the world a better place, but it's kind of slow, and people who are suffering for one reason or another, well, okay, so we're making things better, but they're still not getting that benefit, right? Like they're still waiting for things to get better so they can get out of whatever situation that they're in. So I think like this is about making a contribution to understanding how the advancement of human understanding works itself. It's about understanding universals, potentially universal laws of nature that can help like different domains of scholarly inquiry be able to relate to each other a little bit better on the same things they share in common. But it's also about, for me, universal problem solving. Like if one can understand the fundamental rules how reality works, then maybe we can practice getting better equipped to deal with any given situation that comes our way. So the book doesn't really tell people, it doesn't tell people like what to think. It's more just like a toolbox of and maps of like how we develop as people, and you know, some, it puts forth like some theorems with some axioms to support like or to give like a very clear explication of what these arches are, so that you know people can practice them in their own unique ways in their own life, or in their own pursuits, whether that's scholarly or not. And then they're put forth as like propositions. So if people discover things that aren't quite right, or what have you, then they can come back and then we can have conversations and we can update our sense making from what we found to sort of say, all right, we're trying to get to the most universal natural laws of the universe that persist across physics, persist across life and psychology and so on. But also like stay open, you know, just like we do in science. It's like stay open to new possibilities, new ideas, and so we can increment further to getting higher resolutions and work out whatever errors that we have in these kinds of things.
That's a noble goal. Yeah. And you said that people can take a look at the book at arc.voyage. Is that ARC?
Yep.
Dot voyage? Arc.voyage.
Yeah, there's a free
not,
version.
Not to be confused with arch.voyage. Not there. Arc.
Not arch. Yeah, it's ARC. Yeah, I'd say check out our website and check out the free book that's on there. And if it's interesting, there's the second edition, which is twice the size and it has a bunch of images and diagrams. You can find that on Amazon, the second edition. Well,
Okay.
thanks for having me on.
Yeah, this
Deeply
has
appreciated.
been really interesting, Corey. Both to get to know you in the pre-call and to have this conversation today, and maybe we will at some future day have a conversation with you and Brendan Graham Dempsey to look at his
Great.
contribution to the book as well. Have a great day. Also, before I go, I probably should say I don't know when this is going to publish, but if it publishes before September 12th, that is the beginning of the Estuary Northwest 2024 conference, at which I will be speaking in Olympia, Washington. And I'll put the information in the description below the video. So thank you, Corey. Have a great day.
Thanks.